Good evening, and welcome once again to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM, San Francisco Bay Area. I'm your host, Jeff Hayden. In 2014, California voters chose to classify certain crimes as misdemeanors that had theretofore been charged as felonies, unless the defendant had certain very serious prior convictions. That vote, known as Proposition 47, also allowed resentencing for those who were then serving a prison sentence for any of the offenses that the initiative reduced to misdemeanors. Finally, it created the Safe Neighborhoods and Schools Fund to receive appropriations based on savings following the passage of the initiative. That was 10 years ago. In the years since, we've seen coverage on television that suggests an uptick in crime. Is that a fair depiction, or has crime remained at historic lows? Has the increase in property crimes, how is it different from what we see throughout the country? Oregon, which had gone further towards legalization of drugs than California did, has started to reverse course. Is there a lesson there for California? Some law enforcement groups have blamed Proposition 47 for an increase in property crime. Others, including Governor Newsom just last week, commented that the surge in organized retail theft was not only uncommon at the time Proposition 47 was passed, but would never have been affected by Proposition 47. That is, those large thefts remain chargeable as felonies. Tonight in Your Legal Rights, we look back at Proposition 47, where we were before it passed, where we are today, and whether we should make adjustments or whether we should stay the course. As always, we have a panel of outstanding experts here to help us sort things out. It would be hard to envision greater expertise than we have on tonight's guests, but our final most important guest is all of you, and there's much to discuss. Our phone number right here is 415-841-4134. Again, 415-841-4134. If you're outside of the San Francisco Bay Area, call us toll-free at 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. If you want to call in a related criminal law or policing question, you don't have to jump in exactly where we may be in our conversation. And bear in mind that our guests are here to educate, but they can't provide precise legal advice to your particular case. They haven't seen all the facts, and the opinions expressed here don't necessarily reflect the opinions of their employers, their clients, KALW, or the Bar Association of San Francisco. Joining us tonight, Judge Eugene M. Hyman served as a judge at the Superior Court of California, County of Santa Clara, for some 20 years, where he served in the criminal, family, juvenile, and probate divisions of the court. He has lectured on issues of domestic violence. Besides the U.S. and Canada, Germany, Australia, and New Zealand, he received a United Nations Public Service Award in 2008. Retiring after many years of service as a police officer, a lawyer, as well as a judge. Also joining us tonight, Dr. Charis Kubrin is a professor of criminology, law, and society at the University of California, Irvine, and has studied such things as the effect of immigration and crime, the neglected role of neighborhood in the context of recidivism studies, and yes, the effect of Proposition 47 to crime. Matt Soderosen has been a public defender for over 25 years. In 1998, Matt began his work as a criminal defense attorney with the Alameda County Public Defender's Office. In 2006, Matt moved across the bay to work as a trial attorney in the San Francisco Public Defender's Office. Matt has tried over 50 cases to verdict, ranging from misdemeanors to sex crimes to homicides. Matt is a graduate of UC Berkeley and UC Law San Francisco. Will Matthews began his career as an award-winning investigative reporter, then served in media relations and communications for the American Civil Liberties Union in New York and the ACLU of California before becoming the director of communications at Californians for Safety and Justice, or CSJ. CSJ works with Californians from all walks of life to replace prison and justice systems waste with common sense solutions that create safe neighborhoods. CSJ was one of the authors of Proposition 47. And I would be remiss if I were not to mention that I personally reached out to the offices of the district attorney in San Francisco, San Mateo, Santa Clara, and Los Angeles counties. Each either responded that no one was available to appear tonight or failed to respond at all. But as I said, we're blessed tonight. We welcome an outstanding panel of experts. Judge Hyman, Professor Kubrin, Matt Soto-Rosen, and Will Matthews, welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Will, based on your discussions, I would like to start with you and just ask you generally, what was the state of the law before Proposition 47?
Jeff, first, thanks for having me. Appreciate the opportunity to be here. And it's an important question. I think it's really important when analyzing, the current landscape that we give ourselves a little bit of a history lesson and remind ourselves the context out of which Proposition 47 emerged a decade ago. That was a time in California where we were in the midst of one of the most significant public safety crises in our state's history. Crime rates certainly were higher then than they were today. Our prison system was stuffed to the gills. It was at 200% of capacity. That overcrowding was leading to deaths weekly of prisoners due to medical neglect, a direct result of the fact that the system simply could not care for the people that were in its care. Importantly, the state's recidivism rate at that point in time was upwards of 75%, meaning that within the first 3 years of a person being released from state prison, they were being arrested once again for committing a new crime. We were failing to achieve public safety in the state of California by every conceivable measure. And voters in 2014 wisely said, we need to take a more comprehensive, a broader approach to achieving the safety in our communities that every Californian deserves. And they approved overwhelmingly Proposition 47, which did a couple of things, right? First, it reduced, it right-sized, I would say, the penalty for two of the lowest level crimes in our state's penal code, petty theft and simple possession of drugs for personal use. Instead of sending people convicted of those crimes to state prison for a year and a half to 3 years at a time at extraordinary taxpayer expense, those folks now are eligible for sentences of up to 1 year in local jail. And the other thing that Prop 47 did, which is crucial, is it identifies on a yearly basis the savings that have been realized from the resulting reduction in state prison incarceration, and it reallocates those dollars back to local communities for crime prevention programs aimed at folks who have a history of incarceration and who are vulnerable to recidivating for any number of reasons. Maybe it's because they're having trouble finding a job. Maybe it's because they're still battling an addiction or a mental health challenge. Maybe they're having problems achieving stable housing. Maybe it's all of those things, right? But this is programming that has been stood up to help stabilize and reduce recidivism among this population. The dollars have also stood up trauma recovery centers across the state that provide wraparound services to victims of crime. All of these programs have helped bring extraordinary stability to our neighborhoods. And the result for years after Proposition 47 went into effect was a yearly reduction, especially in property crimes. Year over year, property crime sunk to the lowest levels we've ever seen in the recorded history of the state in 2020.
Let me ask you to that end. We've seen a lot of coverage on, and this is an open question to whomever cares to answer it, but we've seen a lot of coverage in the mainstream media painting a picture about organized retail theft and smash and grab, car burglaries and robberies, stealing from people in their cars, even assaultive and hate crimes. Were any of these types of crimes affected by Proposition 47's passage?
Well, I'll speak to this question as the resident criminologist here. So what's interesting is the research that's been done that's looked at the impact of Prop 47 on violent and property crime sort of right after its passing, including work that I and others have done, shows that it's really had no impact whatsoever on any of the violent crimes and no impact on burglary, very modest impacts on larceny and auto theft, findings that are questionable when you subject them to what we call robustness checks or the ability of the findings to withstand alternative specifications. More recently, interestingly, Prop 47 is coming back as the culprit for what people are concerned about in terms of rising property crime rates, rising violent crime rates. And, you know, part of the issue is you can't simply look at crime trends and then pick whatever causal factor you want to be responsible for them. That is not a proper study or evaluation of a policy, in part because crime is multifaceted and it's caused by many factors. So you need proper evaluations or studies. Absent those studies, though, there is no reason to believe that Prop 47 has had any impact on smash and grabs and organized retail theft, in part because they have nothing to do with each other. Most of these highly organized retail theft rings involve stolen property of way more than $950. Certainly when we add in firearms or other kinds of instruments, they become violent crimes and automatically should be charged as felonies. So what we're talking about here with Prop 47 is really disconnected from these larger crimes that people are particularly worried about at the moment.
And even Governor Newsom, in addressing some of these mob groups that would go in and do these thefts, even he said that these would not have been under Prop 47, but that begs the question, what crimes were affected by Prop 47? And it's actually a surprisingly short list. Who would like to address that? Judge? Judge is waving. Matt, you want to jump in? What crimes were affected by Prop 47?
Yeah, I mean, just to piggyback on what Charles and Willis said, the Prop 47... I love Will's phrase of right-sized these what are some of the smallest crimes in the penal code. And so Prop 47 doesn't even cover auto burglaries. If someone breaks into your car and steals something out of the car, that would not be covered by Prop 47. That could be charged alternatively as a misdemeanor or a felony under California law and is often charged as a felony, especially if the person is a repeat offender, at least in my experience. In the counties in Northern California where I practice. But Prop 47 only covered shoplifting, where the amount that's stolen is below $950, and it did raise the amount up to $950. It had been at $400 for so many years without having any cost of living increased or accounting for inflation. And by the way, I looked this up before I came on this show. There are 40 states in the United States that have a higher limit that demarcates between petty theft and grand theft above California's $950. So some have suggested we need to return to having it lower and having the line be at $400 to have something be a grand theft, which would be a felony. Texas has for example, their line between petty theft, misdemeanor, and grand theft is $2,500. There's a number of states that have higher above $1,000, and there's 40 states in total. Prop 47 only covers receiving stolen property, again, where the value of the property is under $950. A forged check, for example, which is a form of theft, that's under $950, and fraud. And then it also covers simple possession of a very small amount of narcotics. I remember when I came to San Francisco in 2006 as a trial attorney. I had a client who was accused of selling I think it was 0.2 grams of crack cocaine. And because he was accused of selling it, he was facing 20 years in prison based on the laws at that time. And the case was successfully tried to the jury said that the client was guilty of simple possession for personal use. But because that was a felony at that time, that particular client was sentenced to a year in the county jail and probation after that. Today, that same simple possession of a small amount of narcotics for personal use would be a misdemeanor. And that's all that Prop 47 covers.
Which is actually a surprising number of people, because most people aren't out there committing armed robberies. The vast number of people that were in prison were actually there for less serious offenses. And, of course, that diverted a lot of resources away from some of those more serious offenders. Judge, am I off track on that?
No. I want to address a little bit different of an issue from a judicial observation standpoint, although I've been retired a number of years now. A couple of things that irritate me about the false narrative that Proposition 47 is responsible for so much in terms of problems is that Prop 47 allows prosecution and incarceration for up to 1 year. You can actually do 3 years in the county jail if you're convicted of multiple misdemeanors. You can cumulatively serve up to 3 years. That's number one. Number two, the police, prosecutors, and the courts, including judges, are not availing themselves to the availability of what Proposition 47 allows. Too many people are taking the view, well, it's only a misdemeanor. Well, I can assure you that the majority of the public cares about misdemeanors. Not only that, a misdemeanor conviction allows the court, in conjunction with probation and other collaborative agencies and partners, to intervene and try and help people. Most of the people that are involved in theft are doing it for purposes of substance abuse, or they have mental health issues, or they're homeless, or other kinds of collateral issues. And these things are not being addressed. The legislature has done no favor to those of us in the system, because they've reduced misdemeanor probation from a 3-year max to 1-year max, with the exception certain crimes can have a longer period of time. And with respect to felonies, which could have been 5-year max, is now a 2-year max, again, except for certain felonies. It's very difficult to rehabilitate someone who has a substance abuse problem in a 1-year or even in a 2-year situation. So the legislature has done us absolutely no favors whatsoever. The other problem is that you have people, because of COVID, prior to vaccinations, the system did all that it could to not have people in the county jail, because in many cases that amounted to a death sentence. Well, now we have vaccines, but yet we still have a similar practice of releasing people. And then so you have people that have been released numerous times, and they fail to appear, and they're caught, or they are picked up for theft and then continue to commit theft while they're out on release for a prior theft. Well, it's within the purview of the system to do a hearing to see whether or not it can be demonstrated within the meaning of the Humphrey, a Supreme Court case that says there must be clear and convincing evidence before you can set bail. Well, I suggest to you that multiple failures to appear and multiple continuing to offend while you're out on release would satisfy that burden. So I think there's a lot that can be done.
So what you're basically suggesting is that if the judiciary were properly using tools that they already have at their disposal, you may not be sentencing people to prison, but you're certainly upsetting their ability to carry on business as usual. And whether it's to hold somebody in pretrial detention pending their resolution of their case, or using that 1-year max or that 6-month max, instead of saying, oh, this is now considered the same as driving on a suspended license, there are ways to interrupt the flow of people.
Absolutely. And it's not being done, because too many people, police officers, prosecutors, and judges in certain communities are not treating misdemeanors seriously.
You know,
Add something else. And I'm curious if Sharis has any data on this, because locking people up or threatening them with longer jail sentences because of petty thefts, or keeping people in the system by having them on be on probation for longer periods of time actually does more detriment to them in terms of reintegrating and becoming a productive member of society. So I think in a way, my reaction to what the judge just said is it demonstrates how the criminal court system is inadequate to try to solve this societal problem. I sense the judge's frustration, and I agree that we shouldn't, as a society, be using the court system and jails in order to help people that need support with drug treatment, with housing, with food insecurity, et cetera. And if you look at the legislative analysis behind AB 1950, which is what the judge referenced in shortening probation periods, I think there's data to support why it was to the society's benefit to shorten that. And I'm wondering if Sharath has anything to back me up on this.
Yeah, it's a great point. So I think what we know about the relationship between incarceration and crime is that at low levels, incarceration can be an effective deterrent. It can lower crime rates. But very quickly, it loses its power to continue reducing crime. In other words, the return benefits of ever increasing incarceration rates level off very quickly. And as you mentioned, Matt, at very high levels of incarceration, at mass incarceration levels, we actually see the opposite effect. It can be more harmful to society through reproducing inequality, having more folks out of the labor market, having family members incarcerated. So while incarceration is one tool to combat crime, it should not be the main tool, and we cannot over-rely on incarceration to solve our problems. Incarceration should be for only the most serious offenders in society. And to go back to Will's history lesson, when I came here in 2011 from the East Coast, and realized how over-incarcerated California's state prisons were, it was very clear to me that it was not working and that something had to change. And these reforms were part of that discussion, obviously.
And Sharath, as you know, no less than the United States Supreme Court said to California, you guys need to figure out how to do a better job of maintaining safety in your communities, because you cannot continue to over-rely on incarceration. And that, frankly, was really the underlying premise of Proposition 47, that we can't only rely on this deeply broken system that Matt and Sharath and the judge have painted a really good portrait of, right? We can't only rely on this very broken system to achieve the safety in our communities that we all deserve. We have to also rely on community-based crime prevention, well, right? We've got to expand what our approach is to achieving safety. And that's what Prop 47 has enabled us to do. And that's why I say that, in fact, Proposition 47 has been one of the most successful ballot initiatives in state history.
You know, based on what you were saying before we started, Will, there's an argument to be made that if you want to reduce crime, if you want to slow this train down, the certainty of capture is far more important than is the length of time that you're punished. Because if you know there's no gain, why run the risk, even if it just means being taken out of the system for a day? Judge, I'm turning it to you for a moment, but we do have a call coming in, and we're
all right,
close to the half hour.
Look, I understand what our other guests have said, and I think I've been misunderstood. I think that incarceration is for the last resort, not the first resort. And I'm frustrated in the sense that, what do you do with a person who fails to appear on a regular basis? What do you do with a person who's out on an open recognizance release for a crime and continues to commit crime? I don't think you have any choice but to incarcerate. You can debate for how long, but what else do you do with a person who's basically thumbing their nose to the system? The other thing,
I don't think. Yeah, no, sorry.
I just had a couple more comments to make. That is that the purpose of probation is to allow an opportunity for rehabilitation. To, if you don't have the possibility of incarceration, then why should you go to the intervention programs? Why should you go to substance treatment if you can't possibly for testing dirty or not going and there's no consequence for it? Why would you go? Because they're not going to go has been based upon my experience. Now, you have to have the programs have to be reasonable for people who have mental health issues and that are homeless, that are insecure in all other kinds of ways. I mean, you got to set them up for success, not set them up for failure. But what other option do you have when they're just something or nose and not going, not showing up?
Let me turn it over to Percival from El Sobrante. Welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Yeah, thanks for taking the call. So I have a quick question. I don't know if you're the expert for it or not, but I have a strike that was really stupid, and I'm wondering, is it a 0% chance to ever get it removed and downgraded or disappeared or whatever, or are there possible circumstances to get a strike removed?
And I've heard from clients in various parts of the state, there's a lot of chatter sometimes within the jail that people can enter a plea and rethink it later, and they have a limited time to withdraw it, per se, if it's a strike offense. But Matt, you seemed ready to jump on this one. Why don't you jump in and address that?
Well, I think the caller's from El Sobrante, right? So I guess that's Contra Costa County, maybe. I would see if the public defender's office in Contra Costa County has what's commonly referred to as a clean slate program. I know that Alameda County public defender has a clean slate program. The San Francisco public defender's office has a clean slate program. And if Contra Costa or your county doesn't, I would invite you to come to the San Francisco public defender's office and inquire. I mean, generally speaking, the three strikes law that was written in 1994 is so onerous and so punitive and so draconian that they've written into the law and made it so difficult for people to ever get out from under these crimes. Even someone that suffered a conviction before 1994, it can still count as a strike. And that person didn't even know that they were pleading to something that was strong.
I'm in Contra Costa, but this happened in a different county, in Orange County, and it was like the hanging judge. So does it matter what county you live in? Like, can I go to San Francisco County
No.
and say, hey, I'm
Yeah, in? You absolutely. You okay. should go and inquire because it involves, you know, filling out forms that eventually will go to the Department of Justice in Sacramento. And if they're able to help you in any way, then that's what I would suggest that you do. I think what Jeff, the host, said about timing and so forth could be an issue. But I would absolutely check out that program and see if that can help you.
Thank you.
And especially if there is some flaw that they could find, either in the record, in the transcript, if the court or the prosecution or even the defense attorney didn't dot the I's and cross the T's to where you could find some flaw, then there's an opening. But generally speaking, you'll probably do better. Matt, you may disagree with me, but generally somebody familiar with the system there may, in that particular county, may be a little better poised to exploit it if they're not part of it. Do you agree?
Yeah, I do agree. And also, I mean, there might be a chance that if there's a lot of resentencing that's going on right now, a lot of people that are in prison that are sentenced to life in 50 years that are coming back and getting resentenced under a new law. And that's with the prosecutor's agreement. So if you had a compelling case, there's always a chance that a prosecutor's office might be able to undo your plea and you could enter a different plea to a non-strike offense. And that might be a possibility for you as well.
A new law passed in 2022, SB 731, would give you the opportunity to go before a judge and ask for that offense to be expunged from your record. So I would check with the public defenders about SB 731 relief as well.
You're listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM, San Francisco Bay Area. We'll be back right after this.
Support for KALW is provided by the Bar Association of San Francisco. If you live in San Francisco or Marin County, the Bar Association's lawyer referral service can arrange for you to meet with an attorney experienced in the area of law related to your situation. Call 415-989-1616 or visit sfbar.org for more information.
You're listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM, San Francisco Bay Area. I'm Jeff Hayden. Tonight, we're looking back at Proposition 47 with the Director of Communications at Californians for Safety and Justice, Will Matthews, retired Santa Clara County Superior Court Judge, Eugene M. Hyman, Deputy San Francisco Public Defender, Matt Soderosen, and Professor of Criminology, Law, and Society at UC Irvine, Dr. Sharice Kubrin. If you have questions for my guests, our phone number is 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134. If you're outside of the San Francisco Bay Area, call us toll-free at 866-798-8255. Again, 866-798-8255. And as always, you can call regarding any question on tonight's topic, that's criminal law, and particularly Proposition 47. Whatever your question, you're not limited to the exact point we may be in our conversation. And when we were talking before, I did get a notice from a listener who commented that there's a general perception that Proposition 47 is like giving criminals a pass for property crime, whether it's a misdemeanor or a felony. And if the criminals believe that Prop 47 is lenient on criminal acts, perhaps that perception encourages them to commit more property crime. And let me turn it to Sharice. Have your studies found anything remotely close to that?
Yeah, well, I'd like to address that because I think this is where a lot of the issues are for Prop 47 is perception versus reality. And I've had folks tell me, oh, you can commit a crime and under Prop 47, the police are not allowed to arrest you. Or if you're found guilty of a crime under that's Prop 47 eligible, you will not go to, you will not spend any time behind bars. If you look in the language of Prop 47, which I encourage all of your listeners to do, you can go find this online and read so that you educate about what Prop 47 does do and doesn't do. You'll see that, of course, police are allowed to make arrests in these misdemeanor cases. And of course, if convicted and found guilty, these individuals should be serving time for their crime. So whatever issues are happening or not happening around that, I don't think lies in the fault of Prop 47, because the Prop 47 in its language allows for individuals convicted of crimes to serve that time. That's very important. Now, so what about perception? This is where it's very important that we get the facts out about Prop 47, whether it's the research or what the law says or what's happening on the ground. And I think because there is a bit of a disjuncture between the law and the books, as we talked about, and the law in action, hearkening back to one of the earlier panelists' comments about people not using the existing tools that we have in place to stop and curb crime. I think it was the judge who mentioned this. Before we go and get harsh and walk ourselves back to where we were in 2011, California owes itself the responsibility of using existing tools, whether that's the tools that the police have, prosecutors have, you name it, to actually fix the problems that are happening in the system at the moment.
What's really perverse is this misperception has been effectively seeded by law enforcement, who then turns around and exploits this misinformation to drive a regressive policy agenda. Now, I want to be really careful because I am someone who is very supportive of law enforcement. I want them to serve our communities to the highest degree possible. But it is really critical that we be honest here about what is going on. And there is a misperception that has largely been driven by law enforcement to push a regressive political agenda. And I think it's really important that voters be eyes wide about that. Because what is at stake here, again, is a comprehensive approach to achieving safety that also prioritizes investments at the local level in crime and harm prevention, investments that would be eliminated if we roll back Proposition 47 and start incarcerating again at the high levels we were incarcerating a decade ago.
You know, in analyzing, go ahead.
Yeah, I was just going to say, I mean, a recent article came out that documented the amount of money that it takes to incarcerate a person for 1 year in California prisons, and it was more than the tuition at the University of Southern California. And when I was starting out as a public defender, I would have clients that were convicted of stealing a loaf of bread from a store in Alameda County, and they were on probation for a felony petty theft, and they would go to the state prison, not the jail, and get very little rehabilitation at state prison for 16 months, 2 or 3 years. And we were paying, you know, $250,000 to warehouse that person for stealing a loaf of bread because you want to be tough on crime. And as Will just said, if we decide, if the voters decide to roll back Prop 47, you're going to eliminate an infrastructure that's almost a $1 billion infrastructure of programs and rehabilitation and services. That's kind of a good first step towards getting away from the carceral policies of the 1990s. And I think Will pointed this out. And if he didn't, he can correct me. We spent $1 billion on Prop 47 treatment programs and resources for communities, and we're still spending $14 billion on prisons. So it's really just a drop in the bucket, and we need to do more to shift our policies away from locking people up for these, what are, like Will said, the lowest level crimes that exist in the penal code.
You know, as a defense attorney, one of the cases that we rely on, Matt, you and I, one of the seminal cases under the three strikes law involved somebody who lifted a slice of pizza out of somebody's hand and ended up getting sentenced to 25 to life under the three strikes law. My question to all of our guests, wide open, is in reducing certain felonies to misdemeanors, have we spared some very, very low-end offenders from the application of the three strikes law?
Well, I'm sure that we have. I'm not sure, you know, that I've seen a number. But of course, judges have always had the discretion to strike strikes, or in the case of crimes that could be either a felony or a misdemeanor, judges always had the opportunity to reduce those crimes to a misdemeanor if they thought that that was the better way to handle it. With respect to the case that you just described, I suspect that that came from some of the more from a more punitive county like Orange, Kern, Riverside, something like that. I don't recall anything like that happening in San Mateo or Santa Clara County. But in any event,
if I could fill in the blank for you, that was the seminal case, the Romero case, that first said, contrary to the wording of the three strikes law, the court does have the ability to strike strikes, and up
but
until
it's
that moment,
at sentencing, not
right.
Before. I can't.
Correct.
I cannot make an offer to you that if you plead guilty in front of me, that I promise you that I will strike a strike. I can only do it at the back end. However, I can reduce a felony to a misdemeanor to get a plea. I can make that promise to you.
But that was the Romero case that goes back, and that's the first case in California that actually said, you can strike the strike at sentencing.
At the back end.
At the back end.
Not the front end.
But that's the first case that ever said it. And before that, the judge created a record in that case and said, look, the law is very clear. My hands are tied. I
Correct.
Can't do anything. And
Correct.
The Supreme Court said, well, maybe you can.
Well, because the decision was based upon the fact that the prosecutor had discretion and the judge didn't, and the court found that that was a violation of equal protection.
I'd like to move on a little bit. It was only 4 years ago that voters soundly rejected another proposition, Proposition 20, which then Governor Jerry Brown described as the latest scare tactic in criminal justice reform. Is the attempt to get a measure on the ballot now to try to do carve-outs from Proposition 47, Is that more of the same? Is that really a scare tactic when there's really no there?
Well, it also allows the police, the prosecutors, to be able to say, hey, we're not able to get the results that the public wants because the laws are inadequate. That's really – it's not so much a scare tactic as it is an excuse for poor performance.
And again, with poor –
yeah, I just wanted to raise an issue that, you know, we're a as it was mentioned, we're a decade into Prop 47, but we're also, you know, a couple decades away from the really harsh carceral policies of the 1990s, and there's been a lot of reforms that have happened since 2011 going forward. But what's different, I think, now, when you say scare tactic, is that, and I think Will might have mentioned this, and I'd appreciate hearing from him because he's a media expert, that because of social media and because of reels and because of video, they say a picture speaks 1,000 words, a video must speak 1,000,000. People have very visceral reactions to seeing videos, these things like someone mentioned the word smash and grab. Now that's a buzzword in the media, smash and grab. There already is a organized retail theft statute, Penal Code 490.4, that came into effect about 5 years ago that covers that we don't need to reform or change Prop 47 to deal with that issue. And as Garth mentioned, if you're using a gun or if there are other things happen, then those are going to be felonies anyway. But people are getting a lot of siloed information by algorithms when you get onto social media. And I think that most people today get their media and get their news from social media. You don't turn on the Channel 5 news or KTVU anymore. That you're probably over 60 if you do that. Sorry to anyone that gets their news that way. But I think most people get it from social media, and there's algorithms in effect. And you can feel like it's doomsday. You can feel like, you know, and the constituents are calling the state senators and the state assembly members and saying, I have a lot of things about this. And it feels like it's really bad. And then those elected officials are sort of duty bound to, quote, do something. And all they can figure out what to do is jack up the punishments, create new crimes. I mean, that's what I see all the time coming out of Sacramento in the last couple of years, is bill after bill to create a new felony or to create a new longer punishment. And we need to, and there's no data to support that that's going to help. All we're going to do is set it up. So we're going to be spending $130,000 per year per person in state prison. So I think that media, the way people get media and the feeling, is different in 2024 than even it was 4 years ago.
There are a couple of points that Matt makes that I think are really important. First is, I think we need to make sure that we are laser focused on solutions that will actually address some of the challenges that we are facing, right? I don't want to suggest that there are not challenges out there, and our leadership, must meet some of the challenges that we are facing, right? But we have to actually be focused on solutions that will address some of these challenges. The other thing I think that Matt named that is critical. And this is something that has implications far beyond, the issue of criminal justice policy and gets right to the heart of the future of our democracy, frankly. But that is the challenges that I think we face in our communities when it comes to, issues around retail theft are clearly exacerbated and blown out of proportion and used actually to propagandize large swaths of our community who, as Matt said, get a significant portion of their information and news from social media. And the advent of the prioritization of video on social media, the advent of reels in recent years, all of this has served to really distort a lot of the conversations around these issues in a really nefarious way. And I think it's something we need to have deeper conversations about, because, again, I think the implications extend far beyond just issues related to criminal justice reform and get to the heart of the future of our democracy.
Let me ask a couple really quick questions because we're running low on time. Does anybody know how the prison population compares to what it was before the passage of Prop 47?
I'll speak on that because I've written a lot of reports around looking at in the incarcerated population. Back when California was at the height of its prison state prison populations, 2008 around, before the reforms went into place, it was ranked among the top one or two states, I think competing with Texas for having the highest per capita state incarceration rates in the country. Since the reforms have gone into place, it's moved about to the middle of the pack. I don't have the numbers right off the top of my head, but the Sentencing Project, which keeps track of all of this for all states in the United States, has a lot of information. And California very quickly has become a model of what can be achieved when you do reforms and downsize the prison population in large part without impacting public safety. So that's quite an accomplishment in such a short time for the state.
You know, we've seen certain types of property crimes spike, at least in public perception, if not in actual numbers. Do the trends in California parallel those in other states?
So I'll jump in on this and then turn it over to the other panelists too. So, I mean, you know, when you talk about crime trends, violent property, it's always a question of what time period are you talking about? Are you talking about for the state as a whole? Which crimes in particular are you talking about? I always tell my students, you have to answer that question thinking about the notion of compared to what. The interesting thing about crime trends is we've seen a little uptick in property crimes in California, but there's a lot of variability around what kinds of crimes we've seen. Interestingly, if you look at the Public Policy Institute of California, they issued a report on different kinds of retail theft, differentiating between shoplifting, commercial robbery, commercial burglary, and organized retail theft. And I think it's important to make sure we're clear what crimes we're talking about around theft, because there's different kinds. The one crime that has not been increasing, except very little in the last year, but otherwise has been stable or gone down in recent years, is shoplifting. And that's the one that is most affiliated or likely to be impacted by Prop 47. The real concern to my mind is organized retail theft. And that, again, has nothing to do with Prop 47. So I think it's important to identify where the problems are and be very clear about what's causing those problems. In this case, I don't think Prop 47 is behind these concerns.
And just to add a little historical perspective.
I wish I could, Matt, but we're basically out of time, and I promised everybody to get a couple minutes to finish. Will, do you want to go first, about 2 minutes?
Yeah. Sure, happy to do so. Appreciate the opportunity. And I think, you know, the first point that I'd really like to make is that, you know, listen, we all deserve safety. Retailers deserve safety, as do shoppers, as do all Californians, and that should not be up for debate. But what also shouldn't be up for debate is that we have to focus on real solutions and what we know will work to combat organized retail theft and other public safety challenges, and not be distracted by political agendas that aren't actually centered on finding real solutions. Baselessly implicating unrelated justice reforms for public safety challenges is an effort to score cheap and easy political points, but it will not get us to real solutions. The high-profile, sophisticated, and organized retail theft that we've all either experienced or seen seemingly on loop on TV are felonies. They've always been felonies, and they're crimes that were not touched at all by reforms from the last decade to our broken criminal justice system. We should commend the California Highway Patrol, Governor Newsom, local law enforcement leadership, and communities across our state for taking organized retail theft seriously and seeking strategies to combat it. Nothing in existing law today prevents law enforcement from cracking down on organized retail theft, making arrests, and holding people accountable. Nothing in existing law prohibits law enforcement from making arrests for lower-level misdemeanor shoplifting either. This point has been made, but I just want to underscore it. Misdemeanors in California are punishable by up to 1 year in jail. So we need to get past this fallacy that somehow Proposition 47 or other criminal justice reforms has somehow made it so that folks who break the law cannot be held accountable. That simply is not true. It's also important that we be mindful that reforms from the past 10 years, including Proposition 47, have been critical in moving California away from its mass incarceration crisis, which wasted billions upon billions of taxpayer dollars on ineffective incarceration and made us less safe. And the success of reforms like Proposition 47 has shown us what can be possible when we prioritize crime prevention over simply responding to crime and harm after they have already occurred. We need to continue to double down on a broad and comprehensive approach to achieving safety in all of our communities. And it would be a grave mistake to turn around and go back to the days where we were over-reliant on enforcement and incarceration, and we were failing to provide the safety that every Californian deserves.
Matt, do you want to take about 2 minutes?
Sure. I just appreciate you, Jeff, for having me on today, and it's really been great to listen to the other panelists as well. I've learned a lot today, and I appreciate that. And I just want to echo what Will said. I think that Prop 47 has been one of the most successful pieces of legislation in terms of addressing some of the issues that have to do with crime in California. In shoplifting, the shoplifting rate, which is what Prop 47 covers, in terms of crimes per 100,000 Californians, was 210 per 100,000 Californians in the year 2022. And these are figures from the California Budget and Policy Center. This is something that's publicly accessible online. And that number is down 17% from the year 2014, which is the year that Prop 47 took effect. So shoplifting rates have actually gone down despite this public perception. Moreover, property crimes in terms of rates, we are at historic lows. In terms of that rate per 100,000 residents, it was about 2,300 crimes per 100,000 residents in 2022, and that was far below the peak, which was almost 6,900 crimes per 100,000 residents back in 1980. So it is helpful to understand the history, and it is helpful to understand that Prop 47 has started to create an infrastructure to help the most needy in our society by spending almost $1 billion on needed services, housing, drug treatment, et cetera. And that's what we really need to get to, is the root of these causes. Why do people shoplift? That's what we're talking about, shoplifting small amounts when we're talking about Prop 47. Why do people do that? Why do people need to do that? People don't want to have to shoplift. People don't want to have to suffer the indignity of doing that. People don't want to have to risk going to jail and being separated from their families, separated from their children, separated from their jobs. They want to lead dignified, productive lives. And I think as a society, using the criminal court system is not the way to do that.
Charis, would you like to take about 2 minutes?
Sure. So I'll conclude with just a few recommendations, sort of based on what we've been talking about. When crime rises, or even just appears to rise, we've been talking a lot about perception. You know, the knee-jerk response is often harshen penalties, like create longer sentences. And that is not always the right solution. And I think that's important to reiterate, because, you know, that thinking is what led us or landed California before the Supreme Court in Brown v. Plata because of severe prison overcrowding following decades of tough on crime policies. As I mentioned earlier, at low levels, incarceration does reduce crime. I think it's important to be a tool, but diminishing crime abating returns set in pretty darn quickly with incarceration. So we should be using it as a last resort for the most significant offenders that have committed the most problematic crimes in our society, not for folks committing low level offenses or who have violated probation or parole, especially at the cost of over $100,000 per year per individual. So then the question becomes, well, how do we combat crime? How do we respond to concerns, or whether it's retail theft or otherwise? And I think there's been some thoughtful and targeted responses of this kind, particularly around retail theft, that Governor Newsom and others have put forward. I think supporting or supplementing this legislative framework with localized solutions, as Will suggested, is really critical because communities know what is needed the most in terms of crime prevention there. And what may work in one community may not work in another. So making sure that we have on the ground organic solutions in addition to legislative and incarcerative solutions is extremely important.
Judge Hyman, you want about 2 minutes?
Yes, thank you. I agree with the comments for the most part that have been made by the other panelists. I just feel that there's ample resources available under current Proposition 47. It doesn't require the modifications that are being proposed with legislation and or the new proposition. I just wish that people would use the resources that are currently available. I feel very strongly that misdemeanors are not being treated seriously. And I'm concerned about that because a misdemeanor is an opportunity to intervene, to help people, to deal with substance abuse, and to keep a person hopefully from getting involved in more and more serious crime. I agree also that incarceration should be used as a last resort. However, if a person continues to offend and continues to fail to appear, I don't see what other resource we have available other than to give a wake-up call with at least a short period of incarceration. People cannot be permitted to thumb their nose with respect to the law. And I think we all have a we should all expect it to be kept safe, and we should all be accept that those that are in positions like law enforcement and prosecutors in the courts to take misdemeanors seriously. And I'm not sure in every community if they are.
You've been listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM, San Francisco Bay Area. Tonight we've discussed Proposition 47 some 10 years after its passage. Our guests tonight have been UC Irvine Professor of Criminology, Law, and Society, Dr. Charis Kubrin, Deputy San Francisco Public Defender, Matt Soto-Rosen, Director of Communications at Californians for Safety and Justice, Will Matthews, and retired Judge of the Santa Clara County Superior Court, Eugene M. Hyman. I hope each of you will join me again. Tonight's show was produced by yours truly. Bill Hing is a professor of law at the University of San Francisco. Next week on Your Legal Rights, Mr. Hing will discuss his book, Humanizing Immigration, How to Transform Our Racist and Unjust Immigration System. Best of all, as always, we will take your calls and answer your questions. I'd like to thank again our guests for tonight, and our thanks to all of you listeners for joining us tonight. And at the controls, Joanne Marr. I'm Jeff Hayden. Good night, and zealously guard your legal rights.
Support for KALW is provided by the Bar Association of San Francisco. If you live in San Francisco or Marin County, the Bar Association's lawyer referral service can arrange for you to meet with an attorney experienced in the area of law related to your situation. Call 415-989-1616 or visit sfbar.org for more information.